Welcome to Just Ask, the podcast of the Hive Collective, a digital health platform built to empower women to make educated and informed decisions about their health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Heather Quayle, a leading women's and gender-related nurse practitioner. We provide answers to the questions you may not know how to ask by interviewing experts in nursing, medicine, sexual health, and wellness. We started in 2020 with myself and colleague Dr. Tara Thompson, pharmacist, and now welcome our co-host and leading women's health expert and nurse practitioner, Jackie Piasta. This is a safe space where no question is off limits, and we advocate and encourage listeners to just ask their most intimate questions and to break down the barriers of embarrassment and taboo.
I'm Jackie Piasta, your other co-host and fellow Queen Bee of the Hive. Each month, we bring on a new guest that is an expert and healthcare innovator in their respective field. As the healthcare landscape rapidly evolves, we are excited to be on the cutting edge and have decided to evolve the podcast into the Hive Collective, a space that seeks to equip you to better navigate your health journey. To learn more about our new and exciting platform, check out our mission, vision, values, and initiatives as we discuss our rebrand in Season 4, Episode 1. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're excited you're here and hope you enjoy our show.
So this was a lecture that I did for the Nurse Practitioners in Women's Health and the International Society for the Study of Women's Health. It was the Management of Sexual Health virtual course. We broke it up into big lecture series, but we had little TED Talks in between. So I wanted to share this on my podcast. And this is the neurobiology of trauma and sexual dysfunction. So welcome, and I hope that you enjoy listening for the next 20 minutes or so of the TED Talk to understand what goes on with the neurobiology of trauma and sexual dysfunction. Our objectives today are to define trauma, discuss the science of the neurobiology of trauma, and understand the continuum and the impact of trauma on sexual health. So let's start with talking about trauma. Early experiences, especially traumatic ones, they shape our human development. We develop ways to cope, survive, and defend ourselves against deep and enduring wounds. When someone experiences a traumatic event or experiences any type of extreme fear, our brain chemistry becomes altered and the brain begins to function very differently. Not all experiences have equal impact on the brain. When we think about the neurobiology of trauma, essentially the effects of trauma on the brain, it's really important to understand it because it helps break down some common misconceptions around sexual health and wellness. This is such a large topic, so it's so hard to focus this into 15 minutes, but I'm trying to give you the quick and dirty of the neurobiology and how our brain works and let you start thinking about how this does interfere with sexual health, wellness, and function. Our brains respond to acute stress and traumatic events in terms of how the crisis reaction happens. The first part is the first part, emotional response, and that's our mind's response and how our mind responds. The second is the physical component, and that's the body's response. And then the third part of it is the impact that trauma has on health, not just our sexual health, but health in general. And that is also really important for us to consider. So now let's talk about the three parts of the brain. The brain develops from the bottom up. It's highly responsive to threats throughout our entire lifespan. The limbic system is organized mainly during the first 6 years of our life, but it continues to evolve in a use-dependent manner. Trauma can have a major impact on its functioning throughout our life. When we think about the prefrontal cortex, that develops last, and it's also affected by trauma exposure, including being able or unable to filter out irrelevant information. Throughout life, it's so vulnerable that it can go offline in response to a threat. So when we think and move through the neurobiology of trauma, and you're hearing this, it's really important that we think about that when the patient's prefrontal cortex is involved, it's going to be responsible for planning and anticipation, sense of time and context, inhibition of inappropriate actions, as well as an empathic understanding. The limbic brain maps the relation between the organism and the surrounding, and emotional relevance. It deals with categorization and perception, and the brain keeper is the housekeeper and kind of the responsibility maker. So now let's think about normal processing in the brain. Our brains are constantly scanning and processing our environment. Sensory information about the outside world is processed through our eyes, nose, ears, and skin. These sensations converge in the thalamus. The thalamus receives all the input from our perceptions in an integrated and coherent experience, and these sensations are then passed in two different directions, either down to the amygdala or up to our frontal lobes. So when danger happens, this is how this traumatic process interferes with normal processing. Danger, as we know, is a part of our life. So let's look at what happens. The brain receives this sensory information and it's sent to the thalamus. From there, the brain sends a threatening signal to our amygdala. The amygdala kind of acts as, if you will, this smoke detector, and it's constantly scanning the environment for potential threats and danger. The amygdala will then integrate sensory and cognitive information and determine whether the situation is a threat or not. If a threat is there, it will be realized by the amygdala quickly and very automatically. And then within the context of this, what will happen is that it's going to then decide what's going on. A threat's going to be realized, and it will help with the use of the hippocampus that will relate this input to possibly past experiences. The amygdala will then send an immediate message to the hypothalamus and the brainstem, recruiting the stress hormone response in the system, and the autonomic nervous system will get involved in order to orchestrate the whole response. When we think about this, especially the autonomic nervous system, we often hear about sexual health and how we have a dysregulation in the autonomic nervous system. So now let's think about the stress response. The amygdala's danger signals trigger this release of a powerful hormone that we all know, which includes cortisol and adrenaline. And those hormones will increase heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing rate. And from there, what will happen is it prepares our body to fight or to run away. Now, if the amygdala that we think about as this smoke detector thinks that the frontal lobes, think of that and the frontal lobes as being this watchtower, that offers a view of the scene from an elevated point of view. So if the amygdala is alarmed, it's going to take time to determine if the smoke, for example, is coming from a house fire, let's say, or if it's a smoke because maybe you have something on the stovetop that produced a little too much smoke. The amygdala simply determines that there is smoke, and it prepares the body to fight or flight. Depending on the degree of the actual stress response, such as how upset the person is or what is going on, or triggers or things of that nature, when we think of a patient that has post-traumatic stress disorder, what's going to happen is it will determine if the prefrontal cortex can come back online to help you realize that the smoke either is simply from a stovetop of XX smoke, or is it something more? Could this just be a false alarm? So to produce this fight-flight response, you have the hypothalamus, and it's going to activate two systems, the sympathetic nervous system and the adrenal cortical system. The sympathetic nervous system uses pathways to initiate reactions in the body, and the adrenal cortical system uses the bloodstream. These combined effects of the two systems are all around that flight-fight response. When the hypothalamus tells the sympathetic nervous system to kick into gear, the overall effect is that the body will speed up, it tenses up, and what happens is it becomes generally very alert. The sympathetic nerves send out impulses to the glands and smooth muscles and to the adrenal medulla to release epinephrine, as well as norepinephrine into the bloodstream. And as we've already discussed, these hormones cause several changes into the body, as we know, increase heart rate, blood pressure. It also may cause the pupils to dilate, the muscles to get tensed up. It's going to also relax other pieces because it's going to allow for more oxygen to get into the lungs. And when we think about some of the non-essential systems in our body, like our digestion and immune system, it's going to shut down so that it allows more energy for emergency functions and trouble focusing on small tasks is what happens. The brain is directed to only focus on that big picture in order to determine if a threat is coming. all of these physical responses are intended to help you survive a dangerous situation and help you with that flight-fight response. Fear, and the fight-flight response in particular, is an instinct that all of us possess. Let's talk a little bit about fragmented memories. When you have fragmentation of memories, it's a type of memory disruption that pertains to flaws or irregularity in the sequence of memories. During a traumatic experience, memories can be encoded irregularly, which creates these imperfections in the memory. It is also described as a memory that's been jumbled, confused, or repeated unnecessarily. When we have memories of trauma, they are often fragmented because they aren't usually put together properly. Instead, they include these intense emotions that happen, sensations, as well as perceptions. Memories of a traumatic event can eventually be constructed into a narrative, but they usually remain very fragmented. And the fragmentation of memory related to the events of trauma means that the individual encoded that trauma based on facts of what they saw, but they're missing the structure and the pieces that put it together into one synthesized memory. Fragmentation of memory is claimed to happen in post-traumatic stress disorder people, and it happens very often. During the traumatic event, you have disassociation that may occur, and it leads to irregularities in the encoding process of the brain. It's important to understand the fragmentation of memory in order for us to help patients understand why they aren't putting the history together in a sequential order and maybe not remembering all the details of the events. So it's really important to remember on this process the three things that happen. The patient can have a wide range of demeanors. They may look apathetic, have laughter, anger. They may appear drugged, dazed, confused, crying, so many different ways to look. They may have that memory fragmentation, and that also can impair the brain's response on decision-making, and they may act in unexpected ways. We hear this all the time with trauma survivors. So how does this trauma negatively impact sexual health? PTSD may impact a variety of sexual outcomes, including sexual desire, function, especially around orgasm and arousal. It may lead to genitopelvic pain, it may impede sexual satisfaction, and it may also cause sexual distress, and it may impede the frequency of sexual activity. When we think of sexual difficulties, it may not remit with PTSD treatment. Research has suggested that PTSD, not just trauma exposure alone, but it is related to sexual difficulties. Having a sexually based index trauma may also confer unique risk for sexual difficulties compared to having a non-sexual index trauma. So when we think about that, that is also really important to think about in general. Also, when we think about us as maybe a sexual society, sex is everywhere. It's in the ads, it's on television and in social media and in conversations had among many people. Recent data shows that the average partnered female identifying person between 25 to 59 is having some form of sexual contact weekly. These numbers, made to many, indicate that we as a society have decent sexual lives. For a trauma survivor, that may impact how they look at things, and they may feel like they aren't normal because of the messages and cues that we hear about in our society. When we look at sex as trauma, it's based on the information that it appears that society may have become one without a whole lot of knowledge around this. We don't talk about trauma enough. This includes not having real conversations with our intimate partners around the pros and cons of sex, and it appears that a lot of our patients don't have that communication. The most recent statistics from the National Sexual Violence Research Association showed that 81% of women and 43% of men will experience some sort of sexual violence in their lifetime. If it is already hard enough for people to discuss sexuality with those that are engaged in the act, what does this actually mean for the sexually traumatized? To further complicate these large numbers, 51% of these incidences are not even reported by people, and if they are, it's often through people they know. This makes future intimacy, when we think about these patients, very complex, and it can also cause a lot of issues. It may look like disassociation during sex, hypervigilance, hypersexuality as a means to control their own sexual narrative. These things become much more commonly known. However, it's very difficult how to know how to navigate these changes and that are taking place mentally, physically, and emotionally. In terms of the effects of sexual trauma, I will say you can see all these different types of effects, but in several of my patients, they may willingly initiate sex or an aspect of a partner's sexual invitation, but then maybe during the sexual encounter, they may begin to experience anxiety, panic, and they may even disassociate. Sometimes a subtle cue, such as a smell, cologne, or having a partner whisper in your ear can trigger these anxiety feelings, especially if the perpetrator had the same, maybe distinguishing characteristics of the partner that they may feel safe with. This can be terrifying for a person and their partner, particularly if they're willing to engage in consensual sex and they've had discussion around it. So it's really important to have these conversations with our patients. Although the effects of a sexual trauma can be lasting for many women, it's important to remember that women heal from the effects of an unwanted sexual encounter. Women are incredibly resilient, and many are able to recover from the trauma completely with no longer having any difficulties in this as well. So I think it's important to remember these tips. Know that we as a society do not have a great grounding in sexual health. We need to communicate more. All of us need to understand PTSD. If we come to things from a perspective of every patient has a sense of trauma, we will do better for our patient. Lastly, it's really important to understand that our body is crucial and it's huge in terms of issues of sex education and consent. Our body is smarter than we think it is. And it's also important for implications for practice that we developed a trauma-informed approach to care. Be effective at being a trauma provider, and know that if you experience, most people will experience some form of trauma, and coming at it from a form of knowing this as a provider is essential and it is key. You have my information here for if you would like to reach out to me, if you have questions. Again, so much information. This only touched 15 minutes of the surface, but I wanted to give you information as well. You have my slides. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out, and you can also follow me as well on my Instagram. I put a lot of things on there around trauma-informed care. Thank you again for coming to my TED Talk.
Thanks for listening to the Just Ask podcast. And thank you for our amazing panelists today and every day. Feel free to contact us publicly or privately with your questions and thoughts. We do not provide medical advice, but we can point you in the right direction and provide resources. You can learn more about the topics we've discussed in this episode by viewing the show notes for this podcast and following us at Just Ask ATL on Facebook and Instagram. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, Google, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Please make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. If you found value in this discussion, please share this podcast with friends or leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks again for listening. We can't wait for you to join us for the next show.